exactly that. And in fact, Putin himself, 20 years ago, he was the one who was encouraging the George Bush administration, George Bush Jr. administration, to work together. He was the one, in fact, even in 2015, 2014, was encouraging Barack Obama to work together on this kind of issues. Clearly, that time has long gone, and now Putin is going to be a lone actor in this, which unfortunately really doesn't bode well for Russia, because we probably will see more attacks like that. And if Russia is not going to listen to Western warnings or any warnings, then, in fact, how it is going to fight a rising threat? I mean, we saw already that France has raised its security level to the highest level. So if it is a threat, once again, a global one, and Russia will be left alone to do that, that would become a problem.
Joshua Yaffa, the piece that you wrote before this piece that you wrote on how will Putin respond to the attack came around the time of the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's headlined how Putin's invasion of Ukraine improved his standing in Putin's invasion of Ukraine improved his standing in Russia. And you write, Putin's authoritarian drift has accelerated into something resembling a full-blown military dictatorship. How will this attack impact where he's headed? I mean, we see overnight massive attacks on Ukraine trying to, do you think it's trying to redirect attention back to Ukraine? And what do you say to those who are saying they were headed to the Ukraine border, that whether or not some of these attackers were Tajik, that there's some hand in it by Ukraine?
I'd say a few things. One, indeed, this is a trend that began before the war, but accelerated greatly since Russia's invasion, which is Russia's authoritarian drift, empowering of the security services, really the FSB, the main security service, becoming kind of the political police of Russia. These are trends that began a long time ago, have accelerated since the invasion. But what we see is that for all of Putin's authoritarian kind of gathering of authoritarian control and handing over much authority to the FSB, that these institutions are there to protect the regime, not the Russian people. And I think that that's the great lesson of late stage Putinism, what we're witnessing now, but really true of so many autocracies, that as they hand more and more control to things like security services, secret police, carry out mass repressions against their own citizens. A analysis by a group named Proyekt, an independent Russian media outlet, counted more political prisoners under Putin than were under the leadership of Khrushchev or Brezhnev in the Soviet period. So we're talking about a massive number of Russian citizens facing these repressions. And what is it all for? Not to actually keep Russia or its population safe, but to keep the regime safe. And I think that's important to understand, both in trying to determine how did this attack happen in the first place, and also what might Putin's response be going forward. First and foremost, he cares about preserving his own power and the continued stability of his ruling system. How he might respond in terms of lashing out at Ukraine, trying to redirect attention to Ukraine. You mentioned a massive Russian drone and missile attack against Ukrainian targets today against the center of Kiev. A university, among other targets, was struck. The city of Kharkiv is undergoing rolling blackouts, you also mentioned. So, yes, of course, this will be tempting for the Kremlin to try and deflect from the real, by all accounts, source of this terror attack, Muslim fundamentalism, ISIS, try to redirect to a more convenient, sellable target, Ukraine, that fits more in line with Russian overall Russian propaganda messaging. But it's not really clear how much there is slack in the rope, so to speak, for Russia to escalate more in Ukraine. What can it do more than it's already doing? These attacks against Ukrainian cities, against Ukrainian infrastructure, they have been going on, well, really for 2 years since the invasion began. But in last weeks, we've seen Russia ramp up the scale of its these kind of swarm attacks of ballistic missiles, drones against especially energy targets, trying to force blackouts, heating shutoffs and crises across Ukraine. So all of that was happening before these attacks. Can Russia do more of it? I guess, but it's hard to think of Russia escalating in a qualitative way beyond what it's been doing for the past 2 years. As to whether or not there was actually any Ukrainian links to this account, there's been absolutely zero credible evidence of this that has emerged. The suspects were detained on a highway near the Russian city of Bryansk. It's about 140 kilometers from Ukraine. Were they actually headed to Ukraine? Who knows? The idea that they would cross one of the most monitored and heavily militarized borders in the world. Just imagine what the border between two countries at war looks like, the amount of military personnel, intelligence personnel that are watching that border, the idea that people who just committed a terror attack and could kind of easily sneak across the border seems a little far-fetched to me. But again, we don't even know exactly, were they planning to cross the border? Were they planning to cross the border to Belarus? To say that they were apprehended at the Ukrainian border is a bit of a stretch, given we're talking about a distance of 140 kilometers. And beyond that fact, which really in and of itself may not amount to much, there's really no other evidence whatsoever that would suggest Ukraine has anything to do with this attack beyond the Kremlin's understandable urge to try and force that narrative first and foremost on the Russian public to explain why the Kremlin didn't see this coming and wasn't able to prevent it.
Professor Khrushcheva, to talk about those energy attacks, this from the Financial Times. The U.S. has urged Ukraine to halt attacks on Russia's energy infrastructure, warning the drone strikes risk driving up global oil prices and provoking retaliation. Your response?
Well, and it is, because the Joshua just talked about the recent Russian attacks that were before the Friday terrorist event. In fact, during the elections, during that process of Putin's new term of the president, Ukraine escalated its attacks on the cities around the Russian border and on the oil and gas infrastructure. So Russia retaliates back. So in a sense, it becomes, you know, escalation on one side, escalation on the other side. This is not to equate, because obviously Russia is an invader, but it is, you know, the escalation now in the last month has been going on both sides. I don't think Ukraine cares. I mean, Ukrainians did say they understand what the United States is asking for, but they really can't care about this because they are at war. They fight the way they can, especially now when the Western aid, especially the aid from the United States, has been stalling in Congress. They have to do something. So they're doing what they can. And I don't think it's quite fair on the part of other parties involved to say, well, don't do it, because they're at war and they have to fight by any means, by the means possible.
Joshua, you write in your piece, ISIS is on the Kremlin's list of terrorist and extremist organizations, but so was Alexei Navalny's political network. And on the day of the attack, Friday, Russia added the, quote, worldwide LGBT movement to the same list. What purpose does this list serve?
That's a very fair question that I would be that would be difficult for me to answer convincingly or rationally. But the existence of this list, or rather its composition, the fact that you have ISIS on the same list of banned terrorist and extremist organizations next to Alexei Navalny's political and anti-corruption foundation, or something that I'm not even sure any fair-minded person could understand how to define, the so-called worldwide LGBT movement, whatever that is, shows the Kremlin's priorities in how it sees or what it sees as true dangers. And this gets back to what I said a moment ago, that the existence of this security apparatus and the reason for this granting so much power to organizations like the FSB, the scale of political repression we've seen in Russia, it's not about protecting the Russian people. This is a point I made a minute ago. It's about, first and foremost, protecting the political power and the political regime of Vladimir Putin. And who is a threat for Vladimir Putin? Well, for example, the political organization with field offices at one point around the country of Alexei Navalny. LGBT movement, again, whatever that really means, to talk about the worldwide LGBT movement, but by stigmatizing and scapegoating LGBT movement and individuals, Putin is able to present his war in Ukraine as a kind of civilizational values war against the decadent West with its same-sex marriages and trans rights and so on. So, except there are very real human costs behind the inclusion and stigmatization and scapegoating of groups for example, like LGBT community. Just this week, the first prosecutions or the first arrests we've seen of two people in connection with violation of this law. In other words, these are two people who owned a gay bar in Russia. They have been arrested for this fact and could face prison sentences of up to 9 years for aiding this so-called extremist terrorist organization. So one does have to wonder about the priorities of a political system and a government that equates ISIS terrorists with owners of a gay bar. Who are they devoting resources to track, to monitor, to go after? How are those resources being allocated? And I think some obvious questions immediately arise about, again, the true motives and interests of such a regime based on where they parcel out resources, who they see as enemies, and who are they policing, ISIS terrorists or the owners of gay bars?
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll continue, of course, to follow what has taken place in Moscow. Joshua Yaffa, contributing writer to The New Yorker magazine, longtime Moscow correspondent, speaking to us now from Berlin, Germany. His new piece will link to how will Putin respond to the terrorist attack in Moscow. And Nina Khrushcheva, professor at the New School, author of The Lost Khrushchev, and co-author of In Putin's Footsteps. This is Democracy Now!. This breaking news: the Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun has announced he plans to resign by the end of the year. In addition, Boeing's chairman and the head of Boeing's commercial airplane unit are also leaving. The Justice Department recently opened a criminal probe into the company. There is a meme going around that says, when one door closes, another one opens. Boeing. Next up, we'll speak with the World Peace Foundation's Alex DeWall, who says we're about to witness in Gaza the most intense famine since the Second World War. We'll also talk to him about catastrophic hunger in Sudan. Back in 20 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Gaza, where aid groups say famine is imminent after 5 months of U.S.-backed attacks by Israel. The head of the U.N. Palestinian Aid Agency, UNRWA, says Israel is now denying access to all UNRWA food convoys to northern Gaza, even though the region is on the brink of famine. UNRWA chief Philippe Lazzarini wrote on X, quote, "This man-made starvation under our watch is a stain on our collective humanity." On Saturday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres traveled to the Rafah border crossing.
A long line of blocked red relief trucks on one side of the gates, the long shadow of starvation on the other. That is more than tragic. It is a moral outrage. It's time to truly flood Gaza with life-saving aid. The choice is clear: either surge or starvation. Let's choose the side of help, the side of hope, and the right side of history.
For more, we're joined by Alex DeWall, the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University, and author of Mass Starvation, the History and Future of Famine. His new piece for The Guardian: we're about to witness in Gaza the most intense famine since the Second World War. Alex, welcome back to Democracy Now! Describe what's happening at a time when Israel's now preventing the largest aid umbrella in Gaza, UNRWA, from delivering aid to northern Gaza, where famine is the most intense.
Let's make no mistake. We talk about imminent famine or being at the brink of famine. When a population is in this extreme cataclysmic food emergency, already children are dying in significant numbers of hunger and needless disease, the two interacting in a vicious spiral that is killing them, likely in thousands already. It's very arbitrary to say we're at the brink of famine. It is a particular measure of the utter extremity of threat to human survival. So, and we have never actually, since the metrics for measuring acute food crisis were developed some 20 years ago, we have never seen a situation either in which an entire population, the entire population of Gaza, is in food crisis, food emergency, or famine, or such simple large numbers of people descending into starvation. It simply hasn't happened before in our lifetimes.
How can it be prevented?
Well, it's been very clear. Back in December, the Famine Review Committee of the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification System, and that is the sort of the ultimate arbiter, the high court, if you like, of humanitarian assessments, made it absolutely clear. And I can quote, the cessation of hostilities in conjunction with the sustained restoration of humanitarian access to the Gaza Strip remain the essential prerequisites for preventing famine. It said that in December. It reiterated it again last week. There is no way that this disaster can be prevented without a ceasefire and without a full spectrum of humanitarian relief and restoring essential services.
Can you explain what the IPC is and also talk about the effects of famine for the rest of the lives of those who survive, of children?
So the IPC, which is short for the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification System, is the system that the international humanitarian agencies adopted some 20 years ago to try and come to a standardized metric. And it uses fivefold classification of food insecurity, and it comes out in very clearly color-coded maps, which are very easy to understand. So green is phase one, which is normal. Yellow is phase two, which is stressed. Orangey-brown is phase three, that is crisis. Red is four, that is emergency. And in the very first prototype, actually, of the IPC, this was called famine, but they reclassified it as emergency. And dark blood red is catastrophe or famine. And this measures the intensity. There's also the question of the magnitude, the sheer numbers involved, which in the case of Gaza means essentially the entire population of over 2 million. Now, starvation is not just something that is experienced and from which people can recover. We have long-standing evidence, and the best evidence actually is from Holland, where the Dutch population suffered what they called the hunger winter back in 1944 at the end of World War II. And the Dutch have been able to track the lifelong effects of starvation of young children and children who are not yet born in utero. And they find that those children, when they grow up, are shorter, they are stunted, and they have lower cognitive capacities than their elder or younger siblings. And this actually even goes on to the next generation. So that when little girls who are exposed to this grow and become mothers, their own children also suffer those effects, albeit on at a lesser scale. So this will be a calamity that will be felt for generations.
What are you calling for, Alex Duvall? I mean, in a moment, we're going to talk about what's happening in Sudan. It's horrifying to go from one famine to another. But the idea that we're talking about completely man-made situation here.
Indeed, it is not only man-made, and therefore it is men who will stop it. And sadly, of course, even if there is a ceasefire and humanitarian assistance, it will be too late to save the lives of hundreds, probably thousands of children who are at the brink now and are living in these terrible, overcrowded situations without basic water, sanitation and services. It is a crisis like this cannot be stopped overnight. And it is a crisis that is not just a humanitarian crisis. It is fundamentally a political crisis, a crisis of an abrogation of essentially agreed international humanitarian law, and indeed international criminal law. There is overwhelming evidence that this is the war crime of starvation being perpetrated at scale.
Alex Duvall, we're going to turn now from what's happening in Gaza. We'll link to your piece. We're about to witness in Gaza the most intense famine since the Second World War. We now turn to Sudan, where around half the population has become reliant on food aid. As the United Nations warns, the war-torn country is on track to become the world's worst hunger crisis.
Malnutrition is soaring to alarming levels and is already claiming children's lives. A recent MSF report revealed that one child is dying every 2 hours in Zamzam camp in El Fasher, North Darfur. Our humanitarian partners estimate that in the coming weeks and months, somewhere in the region of around 222,000 children could die from malnutrition. And with the estimated WHO estimates that more than 70% of health facilities are not functional.
The conflict between the Sudanese military and the rival Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, erupted nearly a year ago on April 15th, 2023. It's displaced over 8 million people, around 90% of the population facing emergency levels of food insecurity in Sudan are in Khartoum, Darfur, and Kordofan, areas which have seen some of the most intense fighting. But the UN's appeal for $2.7 billion for Sudan is less than 5% funded. Aid's also drying up in Chad, where some 1.2 million Sudanese have taken refuge. The war has also led to many reports of armed forces using rape and sexual violence as a weapon, and some 19 million children have been deprived of school. Alex Duvall, famine is your area of expertise. You're executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University and author of the book Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. What concerns you most about what's happening in Sudan right now?
Sudan is a different kind of food crisis and famine compared to Gaza. This is one of enormous magnitude. The sheer numbers that are afflicted are hard to grapple with. Sudan is a country of almost 50 million people. Half of them are in emergency situation now. You said earlier, reliant on food aid. Frankly, unfortunately, the food aid is not there. Even as we speak, the World Food Program, which is the largest food aid producer, is cutting its budget. It's cutting its staff by 30% because it's not getting the money it needs. It's not a perfect system by any means, but it's the only system that we've got. And what particularly alarms me about Sudan are really three things. Number one is that, unlike previous food crises in Sudan, the actual core of the economy is being destroyed. The breadbasket of Sudan is not functioning, is not growing food. Secondly, it's a crisis not just in Sudan. Most of the neighbors are affected. You mentioned Chad, also South Sudan, formerly part of Sudan, is also facing a major food emergency. And Ethiopia next door at the same time. And we've never seen so many neighboring countries in this region descending into food emergency at the same time. And this is all happening while the international emergency system is being squeezed. It's facing major cuts. We are simply not responding as required. It's quite calamitous.
I wanted to go to a clip from UNICEF, which warns hundreds of thousands of Sudanese children are suffering from severe malnutrition. This is Jill Lawler, Chief of Field Operations and Emergency for UNICEF in Sudan.
The numbers of acutely malnourished children are rising, and the lean season hasn't even begun. Nearly 3.7 million children are projected to be acutely malnourished this year in Sudan, including 730,000 who need life-saving treatment. The needs for children in Khartoum alone are massive, but this is also true in Darfur, where I was last month on a cross-border mission through Chad. The scale and magnitude of needs for children across the country are simply staggering. Sudan is now the world's largest displacement crisis, and some of the most vulnerable children are in the hardest to reach places.
So how is this remedied, Alex Duvall? Again, nearly 230,000 children, pregnant mothers, and new mothers could die, it's being predicted, in the next few months due to hunger.
Indeed, this is the largest sort of mass mortality crisis that we are facing in the world, and the largest that we have probably faced for many decades, certainly the largest since I started working on this topic 40 years ago at the time of the Ethiopian and Sudanese famines that many will remember from the Live Aid concerts. How is it to be stopped? I mean, the two most immediate things are a ceasefire and the end to the destruction of what is necessary to sustain life and produce food in Sudan. And there doesn't seem to be much sign of that. There's not really much pressure on the warring parties to come to any sort of even basic agreement. They seem to want to continue to fight it out. And various countries are pouring in arms into the country to escalate the conflict. But the other is also to fund this humanitarian operation that is, as you mentioned, totally underfunded at the moment. There are almost no resources available to provide the necessities for people.
And in fact, the World Food Program, you know, we were talking about Gaza, we were talking about the massive cuts to UNRWA. The World Food Program of the United Nations has also massive cuts.
Indeed, it's shocking. I was trying to talk just a few days ago to some old colleagues who work on these issues, and I find that they've been reassigned or they've lost their jobs. We only have one global emergency response system at the moment, and that is centered upon the World Food Program. And so we need to make it work, because if it doesn't work, we're going to find ourselves facing the kinds of crises of mass mortality that we have simply not seen for half a century or longer.
Well, Alex Duvall, we thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University, author of the book Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. We'll link to your pieces on Sudan and Gaza and more. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Shruhav Dokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week, I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.